In 2019, domestic extremists conducted 9 attacks and were responsible for an additional 35 plots, threats of violence, and instances of weapons stockpiling, according to a New Jersey Office of Homeland Security and Preparedness nationwide review.
This is Director Jared Maples of the New Jersey Office of Homeland Security and Preparedness. Welcome back to Intelligence Unclassified, a podcast about counterterrorism, cybersecurity, and emergency preparedness. Join us as we talk to local and national experts in these fields to discuss New Jersey's diverse threat landscape and offer you a unique perspective on current trends and issues facing our great state. If this is your first time listening, then thanks for coming. Please feel free to add this podcast to your RSS feed, iTunes, or Google Play. You can also follow NJOHSP on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at NJOHSP. All links can be found in the show notes and on our website, www.njohsp.gov.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Intelligence Unclassified. Welcome to our next episode of our 2020 Threat Assessment Series. In this episode, we're going to discuss the domestic extremist groups in the United States, their activity in New Jersey, and why they remain relevant to our terrorism threat assessment. To start off, domestic terrorism is violence committed by individuals or groups associated primarily with U.S.-based movements, including anti-government, race-based, religious, and single-issue extremist ideologies. So I know we have a variety of domestic extremist ideologies that are found in New Jersey and within the United States. So today, I'm joined by two of our analysts, Christine and John, who both cover domestic extremists here at the Office of Homeland Security and Preparedness. So Christine, can you start us off? Tell us about what a race-based extremist is.
When we're talking about race-based extremists, they seek to establish the superiority of one racial or ethnic group over others through violence or other criminal activity. So a lot of times this is going to be broken down into the two categories we have of white supremacist extremists and black separatist extremists.
So I see, Christine, that race-based extremists were actually responsible for 57% of all the domestic incidents last year. Can you touch a little bit on a few of those incidents and tell us about the groups and the ideologies that are actually doing these extremist incidents?
So I'm first going to go over a little bit about the white supremacist extremists, and how we define them is that they believe in the inherent superiority of the white race, seeking to establish dominance over non-whites through violence and other criminal activity. So as a part of our threat assessment that we put out every year, we have different threat rankings for our different extremist groups. There is going to be a change in 2020, whereas last year white supremacist extremists were in the moderate category, and they're now getting moved to high this year due to the number of threats, plots, and attacks that were conducted in 2019, which was most notably one of the prominent cases was when Patrick Crucius shot and killed 22 people and injured 24 at a retail store in El Paso, Texas.
So, Christine, you said that going into this year, it's new that white supremacist extremists are moving from the moderate to the high category. And you talked about that high-profile incident with Patrick Crucius targeting individuals at a retail store. Why is it that we're seeing more violence and more high-profile incidents from the white supremacist extremists? Like, you talked about how they're motivated by trying to establish dominance over non-whites. I know in the past we've seen a lot of internet activity and we've seen a lot of flyering campaigns, but why is it that we're seeing more white supremacist extremists that are being motivated to mobilize and actually conduct violence?
One of the things that we've been seeing in the past year is the concept of the manifestos that these extremists are coming up with and posting online. After they arrested Patrick Crucius after the attack, he had posted a manifesto online that had white supremacist extremists and anti-immigration viewpoints. This whole idea of manifestos has transpired from Anders Breivik, who was a white supremacist who killed over 70 people in Norway back in 2011. And he's been the inspiration for multiple white supremacist extremists since then. One of the most notable examples that we see is back on March 15th, when Brenton Tarrant targeted two mosques, killing 50 people and injuring 50 others in Christchurch, New Zealand. He had also posted a manifesto online outlining his motivation for the attack. He cited Anders Breivik and Dylan Roof, who was a white supremacist who killed 9 at a church in South Carolina back in 2015, as two inspirational figures that led him to attack these mosques. Then we had on April 27th, When John Ernest shot and killed one person and injured several others at the Shabbat of Poway Synagogue in California, he also, prior to the attack, had posted a manifesto online stating that he hoped to inspire many more. So this concept of what we're seeing is that all these people are kind of looking at these manifestos, inspiring one another, using these for tactical guidance and serving as an inspiration. And kind of the group that we really need to be most concerned with is the lone offenders in this category, the ones who are not really affiliated with any specific group per se, but they're just having this extra step to take to commit this act of violence. So that's one of the biggest threats that we are going to have to continue to look for.
You discussed how a lot of these individuals who are conducting these attacks are now posting these manifestos online that are being used to motivate and radicalize other individuals. Is that something new, the actual manifesto sharing, or is it now similar to groups like ISIS and Al-Qaeda where people can go online and because of the internet, they're able to access this information and become quickly radicalized?
So I don't think the concept of the manifestos is relatively new. I think it's just more mainstream now because people are able to post online and are able to access this information easily. Now, in the case of Brenton Tarrant's manifesto, they tried to distribute that and translate it into numerous languages to reach a wide variety of people, too. And it was posted on a lot of different online platforms where these people were able to see and reach this before it was taken down. Now, I know a lot of these internet and social media companies are doing what they can to try and censor this kind of stuff and take it down. But once it's in the online world, it's still able to reach a group of people before this happens. So we have the chance of this spreading and reaching other like-minded individuals. And with manifestos, we did have people prior that have posted motivations and outlined the things for why they believe that they do. I just think it's becoming more common where people are just seeking inspiration from one another's, and it's just much easier to distribute now.
So Christine, obviously these white supremacist extremist groups are looking to boost their numbers and continue getting more people on board for their cause and to follow their ideology. So besides reading those manifestos online, what other ways are white supremacist extremists attempting to boost their numbers?
So I'm going to take it back to just an example of in New Jersey, per se, regarding recruitment and propaganda for white supremacist organizations. The groups have actively attempted to spread ideologies and recruit new members throughout the state. So giving, for example, in 2019, there were 168 reported instances of white supremacist propaganda distribution that we know of and that was reported, compared to 46 in 2018. So that just goes to show you the increase in numbers and how they're actively trying to get their message out there. A lot of these mostly are in the form of flyers that are placed in public venues, along with higher education institutions as well. And this goes back to a point where we talked about before that the white supremacist extremists are trying to rebrand their image and they're trying to go for a different demographic of people, to not the stereotypical of what we would think that they would be, going more for the clean cut type of looks and more education. So that's why we're seeing a lot more of that propaganda at higher education institutions as well. Actually, the majority of our flyering and propaganda distribution has been from one New Jersey-based white supremacist group, so it's likely we'll continue to see flyering from this group.
Is that one group that you said is doing the majority of the flyering? Are they the only group that's active in New Jersey, or are there multiple white supremacist extremist groups that are active in our region?
So that one group in particular is the most active in regards to flyering and recruitment. But there are other groups that we see also that are trying to get the message out there with different propaganda throughout locations in the state as well.
Thank you, Christine, for talking about white supremacist extremists. And I know that you will be going more in depth into white supremacist extremists in our high threats category threat assessment that will be coming up in this series. But can we shift gears a little bit to black separatist extremists? I know we had an attack last year from individuals who followed some sort of this version of this ideology. So can you go ahead and talk about that? Like, what is a black separatist extremist? And can you talk about some of the motivation and some of the recent incidents?
So first, when we talk about black separatist extremists, how we define them, that they are individuals or groups that seek to establish an independent nation for people of African descent through violence and other criminal activity. Now, when we look at our threat rankings again, like we talked about with the white supremacists, for the black separatist extremists, this threat category is moving from low to moderate after we had two individuals associated with this ideology that targeted law enforcement and the Jewish community in Jersey City, killing four and injuring three. So what we're seeing now is that these fringe black separatist extremists are conducting these violent attacks, while mainstream members are continuing to promote violent and hate-based rhetoric against law enforcement, government officials, white people, and members of the Jewish community. So like with this group as well, we have to be wary of the lone offenders that are drawing inspiration from this black separatist extremist ideology and can often act without warning.
A big concern is individuals that are lone offenders that are actually motivated by these ideologies as opposed to the groups themselves. So, like I said earlier, we had that attack that happened in December of last year. Would you be able to touch on that and give us some details about that incident specifically?
First, I just want to touch on, in New Jersey, the two groups that are the most active black extremist groups, which are the New Black Panther Party and the Israelite Church of God and Jesus Christ. So now, when talking about the Jersey City incident, on December 10th, we had David Anderson and Francine Graham. They killed three people and injured three when they targeted a kosher grocery store that was in Jersey City, shortly after they killed a police detective that was in a cemetery nearby. The shooters both espoused anti-Semitic and anti-law enforcement views prior to the attack, from what we found. And when looking into Anderson's social media activity, he highlighted direct threats towards these groups and showed support for this Black Hebrew Israelite ideology. And just to kind of give you what that ideology espouses, is that they assert that Black people are the true descendants of the Israelites and that the white and Jewish communities are the enemy, along with law enforcement who protect them. And just to touch on some points that we made before, the groups operating in New Jersey are unlikely to plot or conduct attacks, despite espousing hate-based rhetoric due to their disorganization and lack of consistent leadership. So once again, we have to look out for these lone offenders like Francine Graham and David Anderson committing these attacks that are not part of a specific group per se. The New Jersey Black Panther Party last organized a rally back in 2011 when it protested a national socialist movement gathering outside the State House in Trenton. Also, these members are known to attach themselves to other chapters during highly publicized, racially divisive incidents, which included protests in Ferguson, Missouri, Sanford, Florida, and Baltimore, Maryland. And for the Israelite Church of God and Jesus Christ, they're not really known for violence, but a lot of their members often participate in criminal activity, in particular financial crimes that they believe were ordained by God to help members survive in a world dominated by white people.
With the Jersey City attack specifically, because that happened in our state, and you know that's obviously going to be a concern for our office, have you seen any of these incidents causing other extremists from other ideologies to react, whereas black separatist extremists and white supremacist extremists are both very anti-Semitic in their nature and the ideologies? Have we seen them maybe agreeing with each other or getting into arguments with each other over these types of acts of violence?
And what's actually pretty interesting that we saw with the reactions post the Jersey City attack, in the aftermath, after the attack occurred, a neo-Nazi group was actually on different social media platforms expressing favorable views of these attackers and their methods. And then they also praised homage to previous attacks. So we saw some online group members that were celebrating the attack and calling for a continuation of violence against Jewish Americans and law enforcement officers. They were also praising Anderson and Graham as non-white heroes, along with other previous minority attackers. So these responses came during and after the incident, which just highlights how these race-based attacks are likely to inspire other like-minded individuals to commit further acts of violence.
These race-based groups might applaud each other for conducting attacks because they share that same anti-Semitic hatred that's found in both ideologies.
Exactly. So that's what we're seeing. These groups are coming together because they have a perceived common enemy.
Thanks, Christine, for discussing the various race-based extremists that we have present in our state. So let's shift gears to another domestic extremist ideology, anti-government extremists. In a previous episode of our threat assessment series, we talked about how we added an anti-government extremist as a separate ideology, where we've always looked at anti-government-inspired ideologies. So, John, can you talk about why we added an anti-government specific ideology as a threat category and what the difference is?
We added this category after examining actions of certain individuals who aren't against the government in general, but oppose certain parties or want specific changes and feel that violence is the only way to achieve it. We've always spoken about them in the past, but we wanted to more clearly define a category for them to fall into. A couple good examples would be Cesar Sayoc Jr., who mailed improvised explosive devices to several prominent Democratic Party supporters, figureheads, and officials, and Paul Rosenfeld, who had planned to detonate a 200-pound bomb on the National Mall in the run-up to the 2018 midterm elections. He, again, was not against government, but had hoped to draw attention to a political theory called sortition, where political officials would be drawn at random, almost like jury selection.
Now, I know in the past we've included ideologies such as militia extremists, sovereign citizen extremists, as actual anti-government extremists as well. As a whole, with anti-government extremists, what activity did you see last year?
In 2019, the activity we saw from anti-government extremists focused mostly on verbal threats against elected officials targeted towards specific political parties. Several individuals threatened President Trump, and several other individuals called senators' offices, leaving voicemails with hate-filled rhetoric and threats of violence.
I know typically when we look at anti-government extremists, they're at the core of the ideology. They believe that the U.S. political system is illegitimate and that force is justified to bring about change. Now, because again, like you said, you guys added this threat category to include individuals who might not question the legitimacy of government, but express their opposition to specific policies, entities, officials, and political parties through acts of violence. What about the groups that typically question the U.S. political system and believe that it's illegitimate and want to use force? So I know there's a variety of groups here that fall in the moderate category. Can you go ahead and talk about the militia extremist category first, and then we'll go through the other anti-government extremist beliefs?
So like I said, this new subcategory of anti-government extremists specifically refers to people who don't necessarily question the legitimacy of government. But the term anti-government still functions as an umbrella term to include both that specific subgroup and also groups like militias and sovereign citizens who do inherently believe that the concept of government is an existential threat to their rights and freedoms. While there are militia groups active in the state, none of them have resorted to violence. There are militia groups that operate throughout the U.S., however, that have resorted to violence and violent actions in furtherance of their ideology.
So, John, you mentioned something about sovereign citizen extremists, and I know that that's a term that we hear a lot. Can you tell us what a sovereign citizen extremist is and maybe talk about some of the recent activity in the United States and where we see these groups headed in the future?
Sovereign citizens believe that they are immune from local, state, and federal laws and that they can operate outside of these laws simply by claiming that they never agreed to follow them. Sovereign citizen extremists believe in using violence to oppose government authority and operate outside of a legal system they view as illegitimate. There were several incidents of sovereign citizen extremists resorting to violence around the country, but none of those occurred here in New Jersey. Here in New Jersey, they rely on filing fraudulent liens against public officials or self-identifying to police officers and court officials. While most of their activities are nonviolent, they can resort to violence when confronted. While no sovereign citizen extremists engaged in violent activity in the state of New Jersey, some did resort to violence in the region around the state. In November, Tonya Scott and six associates forced entry into a clubhouse of a private housing community in Bushkill, PA, and held a security guard hostage for several hours. Bushkill, PA is actually right across the river from New Jersey. Scott had claimed to be a Native American indigenous to the Bushkill, PA region, and filed several lawsuits against the housing community, claiming that she was the actual owner of the land that the properties were built upon. After the lawsuits were dismissed, she recruited six associates and showed them fraudulent paperwork supporting her claims and encouraged them to help her evict these residents, offering them homes and jobs if their plan succeeded.
What other incidents did you see over the last year come from sovereign citizen extremists?
Christopher Bruce, a sovereign citizen from Sioux Falls, South Dakota, was arrested after threatening the mayor and city council over a period of 8 months. Bruce, claiming to be a state national, sent a series of threatening emails to the mayor and city council, sometimes referencing the mayor's immediate family. He later admitted, writing in one of the emails, that he believed you could fight City Hall, you would just need bigger guns, better bullets, and harder armor. Last February, police officers in Maplewood, Minnesota, pulled over Dennis Van. Van told police officers that he didn't need a driver's license and was not required to follow any traffic laws because he was a, quote, free citizen. Van threatened officers, telling them that if they tried to remove him from the vehicle, he would kill them, When officers attempted to remove him from the vehicle, he reached for an IED he had stored inside it, leading to a four-hour standoff. Van eventually surrendered, and police were able to recover the IED that had an anti-police message written on it.
Great, John. So thanks for talking about anti-gov extremists. And we talked about how sovereign citizen extremists, militia extremists, and then this new category of just a general anti-government extremist are all featured as moderate threats in our threat assessment. I see that there is also an additional moderate threat that we haven't discussed as the anarchist extremist. So, John, can you go a little bit into what an anarchist extremist actually is?
So while anarchist extremists do oppose government, they also advocate committing violence in furtherance of several social issues, such as anti-racism, anti-capitalism, anti-globalism, anti-fascism, and environmental extremism.
So anarchist extremists seem to believe almost similar to an anti-government ideology, but then they also have these other issues that they see as threats. So can you talk about any kind of anarchist extremist incident that we might have seen in 2019?
So there's one main incident of note. Back in July, Willem von Spronson attacked an Immigrations and Customs Enforcement facility in Tacoma, Washington. Spronson was trying to prevent the deportation of several people there and was attempting to set fire to several buses in the parking lot used to transport detainees to the airport for deportation. Police officers arrived on scene as he was setting a vehicle on fire. When officers arrived on scene, Spronson pointed a loaded rifle at them. Police officers opened fire on Spronson, killing him. This incident kind of served as a fairly significant escalation for anarchist usual activities. In the upcoming year, we still expect to see much of the same from them, which is conducting violence at protests for these social issues that I previously mentioned, and targeting police officers and other perceived enemies at these events.
You said that going into 2020, we may see that anarchists might target perceived enemies and maybe law enforcement. So I remember in 2017, it was a large and very notable incident was the Charlottesville rally, right? And I know that we've talked about it a lot on this podcast specifically, where we've talked about how these ideologies can conflict and groups like anarchists can maybe view white supremacists as their enemy and white supremacists can view black separatists as their enemy and all these extremist groups can view each other as enemies. Can you both, John and Christine, both get into a little bit on how these ideologies might conflict with each other and discuss how going into 2020 that could be a concern?
So much the same as we spoke about anarchist extremists at these events, this is going to be a concern going forward because in the run-up to the election, there's obviously going to be more rallies, more protest events, and we expect anarchist groups to be present at most of them.
Also, the potential for the white supremacist extremist groups to be at these events, trying to get their message out there and utilizing these events as recruitment and other ways to spread their ideologies to people attending.
So you guys talked about the different ideologies and going into 2020, we might see incidents where a variety of ideologies could conflict and could converge in one location, similar to, you know, the big notable Charlottesville rally. Thank you, John and Christine, for coming on today to talk about the various domestic extremist ideologies. This concludes the next episode of our 2020 Terrorism Threat Assessment series as part of Intelligence Unclassified. Thank you very much for listening, and look out for the next episode of the series where we will go further in depth into our 2020 terrorism threat assessment. Thanks for joining us. Intelligence Unclassified, signing out.
All links can be found in the show notes and on our website at www.njohsp.gov. If you have any ideas or topics for future episodes, please contact us on Twitter at NJOHSP or email us at intelunclass@njohsp.gov. Thanks for listening, and don't forget to subscribe to Intelligence Unclassified.